Thanks very much, Pavadarka, brothers in the Dharma. The talk has a title. It's called The Original Mahasiddha. I'm going to start off with a couple of quotes. The thought-free yogin is like a child, like a bee in a flower garden tasting every bloom, like a lion roaring in the jungle, and like wind blowing where it will. If his mind is trained in attention and discretion, his behaviour is immaculate. If there are no checks upon his mind's effusion, the yogin behaves like a divine madman. Riding on the best of buffaloes within the domains of the great forest tribes, he is ornamented with snakes and carries an iron vajra. His hair coloured ochre with bezoar and tied upwards in just the right way, with skulls around his head, let him apply ochre to his beard. He exclaims such mantras as Hri and Stri, brandishing his iron vajra. The lion's roar should be done that way, because it is the vajra practice of Yamari. And if he has developed ability, let him enter a city playfully. In an auspicious dance, he sings the song Sweet Confection and other kinds of songs. So these are two verses associated with the Mahasiddhas. The first is an actual song of realization of the Mahasiddha Maitripa. The second is a description of a Mahasiddha taken from a tantric text. The tantras are the great literary and ritual texts which the Mahasiddhas would have practiced from. And I quoted them because I wanted to give you just a little glimpse immediately of the kind of world we will be entering over the next week or two. The world of the crazy wisdom of the Mahasiddhas. And I'll say right away that it's a very strange world indeed. I've been living in this world, at least in my imagination, for the last week or two. And it's a very strange world indeed. But although it's strange, it's got something to say. Something to tell us about our world and about our practice of the Dharma. And in the next week or two especially, we're going to be hearing stories of some of the siddhas. Some of them very strange stories indeed, highly sort of symbolic stories. And we'll be seeing, again in our imagination, how they look, what they do. They'll be strange, they'll be funny, they'll be entertaining, they'll be shocking. They'll be a bit crazy. But through it all, through all the things that we hear about, we really need to kind of listen to hear them talking to us. They're showing us something about how to practice. The Mahasiddhas are gurus, they're teachers, highly effective teachers. They're able to communicate directly with the heart of the disciple. Not just through words, they seem to be men of very few words, but mainly they communicate through action and behaviour. And hopefully they'll touch us over these next 2 weeks. They'll do something for us, I hope so. If we can just open up to them a little bit, let them come here into this place and show us something. In a way, we're kind of invoking the Mahasiddhas over this next 2 weeks. Hopefully that will happen not just through these talks, but through all the things that we do together on this retreat. We'll be invoking the Mahasiddhas. So today's talk is kind of introductory. I want to talk about the Mahasiddhas in general, and I want to talk about someone who I've called the original Mahasiddha. So you probably all know that Buddhism's history in India was long and glorious. The Buddha himself appeared on the scene 500 or so years before the Common Era, and he sparked off an incredible spiritual tradition, which was sadly, tragically, finally sort of wiped out in about the 12th or 13th century. Although in the 20th century there was a great revival of Buddhism due to the efforts of Dr. Ambedkar and his followers. But the tradition started by the Buddha really kind of came to an end in about the 12th or 13th century. And you can see the remains of that glorious tradition. If you go to India, if you go to North India in particular, and you go to the remains of Nalanda or any of the great pilgrimage centres, you'll see just the foundations of the great monasteries that covered India in its heyday. The Buddha himself, of course, was a homeless wanderer. He didn't live in a house. He wandered the world. He sparked off, though, a tradition which eventually became, which included great monastic cities. We'd have even Buddhist countries. The whole culture was Buddhist. You'd have Buddhist kings. Great religious and secular institutions. In time, Buddhism developed its different schools and traditions and lineages with their particular emphases. An enormous literature was produced, and there were scholars and pandits and practitioners. Of course, great art, wonderful Buddhist art, which you can still see. So it's very important to get that picture in your mind. Try and get that picture in your mind of the world of medieval Indian Buddhism. Buddhism by that time was completely embedded within Indian culture. Certainly had its enemies, its competitors, particularly from Hinduism, what we now call Hinduism. The Shaiva and Vaishnava schools were often very hostile to Buddhists, or there was a very uneasy coexistence between Buddhism and the Shaiva and Vaishnava traditions, probably the Jaina traditions as well. But it was easy to live a Buddhist life. Very easy to be a monk, very easy to be a Buddhist layman, born into a Buddhist family, all that kind of thing. And you would have your religious year with its great festivals, its new and full moon days. Absolutely wonderful culture. From what the scholars are able to discern, in around the 6th century, in the midst of this incredible Buddhist culture, a new kind of Buddhist practitioner starts to appear on the scene. A new kind of Buddhist saint, even, started to emerge. Something really a bit different. They weren't really monks in very nice, smart red or yellow robes, which the monks would wear in the great monasteries, although some of them, many of them, had a monastic background. But they weren't really laymen either, because they didn't really live at home with a family. Or if they did, they weren't your normal type of layman. Some seemed to live like everybody else, kind of. So, they're neither monk nor lay, if you like. This new kind of saint, this new kind of practitioner, seemed to be someone who was dissatisfied with Buddhist institutions, with the conventional Buddhist scene, and with perhaps the inevitable compromises with the world that such institutions can bring. They wanted to break free of the meditational traditions which seem to have got walled up within scholasticism in the monasteries. Very concerned with categories of analysis, that kind of thing, analysis of the different categories that make up personality and so on. They wanted to break free from the idea that knowing reality was to do with any kind of scholastic analysis of Buddhist categories. They wanted to break free of dialectic, of argument and discussion and debate about how things are. They wanted to break free of meaningless rules and regulations that can sometimes afflict the monastic community, and they wanted to break free of elaborate ceremonial. Actually, they wanted to break free, it seems, of being good, respectable Buddhists. These people, the siddhas, were very often wanderers. They'd go from place to place. Some of them seemed to have no teacher. Some of them had gurus, but some of them seemed to have no teacher. They claimed to have been taught directly by a divine guru, by Vajradhara, or Vajrasattva, or Vajrayogini. And they taught, or rather they showed, reality as it is here and now. They seem to be most concerned that reality as a possibility, an actual experience of reality, is possible here and now. In fact, it's happening right now. That was their great message. In all their songs, in all of the things that they sang, that's what they wanted to point people to the spontaneous reality that's happening right now. It's not in the books, it's not in the arguments, it's not in the ideas, it's here and now. So they sang of Sahaja, very often made, not Sahaja, it's Sahaja, that's the proper pronunciation, Sahaja. Very, very hard to translate this term, Sahaja. It can mean spontaneous, natural, easy. Innate is one translation. It can mean co-emergent, or that's much too wordy. But what they're pointing to is the reality, the spontaneous reality that is here and now. And they sang as well of great bliss, Mahasukha. Mahasukha, great, all-pervading bliss. Reality is blissful. It's the great happiness that's everywhere. It's in your body, it's in your mind, and it's there right now. They also sang of strange women, Darkinis, and people weren't sure whether they were kind of demonesses or goddesses. Sky women, the Kachari. They sang of gypsy women and outcast women. They even sang of prostitutes. They sang of hill women in their songs. But this woman, this maiden, was their prajna, their wisdom. The lady that gives wisdom quickly. She wasn't a real woman at all. But she was as well. And they sang not in polished Sanskrit, the language of the Brahmins, the priestly class. No, no, they sang in the language of the country people, the language of the streets and the markets, the language of the hills and the tribes. They sang in languages like Old Bengali, Apabhrangsha. And they sang strange, riddling songs of realization. They lived very strangely as well. Some of them didn't seem to do very much meditation, in the sense of sitting meditation. They just seemed to wander around and drink vast quantities of country liquor. And even if they did meditate, they seemed to just eat and live on dirty food. There's one particular Mahasiddha who's known as Luipa, fish gut eater. He just lived on the stuff from fish that's thrown away. They lived in strange places like cremation grounds or in the depths of the forest or in the very rough parts of town. They lived with disreputable people. They dress in rags or in bone ornaments, but mostly they were naked. And they talked to anybody if they felt like it. Sometimes they didn't talk at all. Just stay silent, sit there with their bulging eyes, obviously getting off on their great bliss. But they talked to anybody, and they seemed to delight in slumming it, though. They'd love to be with the ordinary people. But if they came across respectable people like kings and Brahmins and so on, they'd give them a jolly good talking to. Yes, so they'd hang out with the low caste or the outcast, so-called, sweepers and cobblers and cowherds and thieves and scoundrels and prostitutes and weavers and potters. In fact, some of them, many of them, came from those kinds of backgrounds themselves. So when you see pictures of the siddhas, yes, they're mostly naked, with long hair and beards, with bulging eyes, wearing bone ornaments and a loincloth. They look fierce. They look playful. Sometimes they're fat and ugly. Some of them, it also has to be said, some of the siddhas, and traditionally there are said to be 84 of them. Actually, there were many, many more. Some of them were actually kings or ministers or the well-to-do. They practiced and gained realization as well. But the great concern, the overriding concern, and one of the great messages of these practitioners is that you practice, that you live the Dharma in your situation. Sahaja, the innate, the spontaneous, the natural, was always present, is always present, wherever you are. So whatever the aim of these men, the aspirants, if you like, the ordinary siddhas, and there were some women too, was to become a Mahasiddha. Siddha means accomplished one. So a Mahasiddha is a greatly accomplished one, one of great attainment, great power. One who has siddhi. A siddha is someone who possesses siddhi. There are many kinds of siddhis that are listed, great long lists of siddhis. They're usually associated with great magical power, great magical accomplishment. So the siddhas could often read minds. They'd know exactly what you were thinking. They could hear what was being said from a great distance. They know what was going on the other side of India. They could fly through space. They could walk through walls. They even had the power to turn base metal into gold. They could produce great wealth out of nothing. They could even gain the city of the sword, where they'd have this magic sword that could do all sorts of things. There's great long lists of cities. There's the eloquent city. You can gain a magical power to become eloquent. Very important, very useful, I think. But although these cities, these particular magic powers are mentioned, actually, the Mahasiddhas were really only interested in one city, one magical power. They could employ these other siddhis. They could use them to benefit others. But there was just one siddhi that they wanted. And that was the highest siddhi of all, enlightenment itself, Bodhi. Or in their terms, realization of Sahaja. The natural, spontaneous, ever-present, non-dual reality. That was the siddhi that they wanted. That's the greatest magical power. Or they speak of this siddhi in terms of the attainment of the Mahamudra siddhi. Mahamudra means something like great symbol or great stance. They wanted, which is a synonym really for enlightenment. They wanted that direct, wordless tasting of Sahaja. That was the real magical attainment. So a Mahasiddha is someone who's attained the highest siddhi. They're the great being of the greatest magical power of all, the attainment of enlightenment. These men are depicted as people who are totally attuned to the play of existence. They can handle anything that's thrown at them. They're never phased, they're never thrown. They're masters of it all. They can do anything, anything at all. They enjoy the utter freedom that comes with the realization of Sahaja. Theirs is the spontaneous play of the Buddhas. And that meant they could sometimes be very strange indeed, and hence crazy. And this phrase, crazy wisdom, they had a kind of crazy wisdom that looks crazy, looks mad to us, but really is the expression of wisdom. They look crazy to us because we're out of tune with Sahaja. Very often, their craziness manifested to break through, to shatter the rigidity of the disciple, the rigid notions that the disciple has. And we'll be hearing a bit about that in the course of the talks. But it's very important for us when we hear this phrase, crazy wisdom, which seems to excite people for some reason or another. It's very important not to think that it means, you know, that you're weird and eccentric. It's very important that we don't go around thinking that we're doing crazy wisdom by looking different and trying to sort of shock people and saying, oh, you know, this is a wonderful manifestation of crazy wisdom. It's not about indulging in anger and craving and all that sort of thing and saying, hey, I'm a Mahasiddha. It's not something you can contrive to do at all. If you're thinking, I'm doing crazy wisdom, you're not doing it. So it's not an issue for us at all. So you can forget all about crazy wisdom. No sahaja, no crazy wisdom. So we can forget that. Of course, we are crazy ourselves. I think it's very important to tune into that idea. The Buddha himself once said, famously in the Pali texts, the old texts, all prathajanas are mad. All people who haven't attained some degree of insight into the nature of existence are mad, are crazy, stark, staring, bonkers. They're just weird. We are just weird because we see what is impermanent as permanent. That's a very weird thing to do. That's a crazy thing to do. We try to find something ultimately satisfying in things that are unsatisfactory. That's madness. You see, you do it again and again and again. We try to find the substantial, that which is really existent, in what is fluid and insubstantial and illusory. That's mad. And we try to find what is beautiful in things which are actually, if you really look at them, really rather ugly. Well, that's mad. So we are mad, according to the Buddha. We try in this world of ours to make charcoal white, or like King Canute, we try to sit and order the waves to stop coming in. And they just keep coming. So we're mad. So somebody who doesn't do that, who doesn't see the world like that, they will look mad to us. We think we're sane, actually, you know, from the point of view of a Buddha, we're mad. But the way a Buddha is sometimes, we'll think, like, he's nuts. Just because of the way he's approaching things. But we're also crazy, perhaps, moving towards crazy in the sense that the Mahasiddhas are crazy, because we're aspiring to live the Buddhist life. I mean, let's just take this retreat. If you'd met somebody, and maybe this happened to you before this retreat happened, and somebody said, well, what are you doing for Christmas? And you said, well, I'm going on retreat for a couple of weeks. And they said, well, what will you do? And then, I've actually had this experience, and then you explain, no, there's no television, there's no radio, there's no phone calls, there's no computer, no internet, no emails, there's no meat, no fish, no booze, no women, no men, if you're into that sort of thing, in that sense. This is a totally inclusive retreat. Instead, there's going to be hours of sitting in silence, just watching your breath and attempting to develop loving kindness for other people, sharing dorms with people, and sometimes with people who snore, who have strange nocturnal habits, listening to this bloke, you know, going on all the time about Buddhism, going for nice, healthy country walks, eating vegetarian food. Well, you explain that to some people, they'd think you're stark, staring bonkers, that you really are crazy. So maybe we are already, just through following the Dharma, already on the crazy wisdom path. Which is kind of reassuring, isn't it? So the picture I conjured of the Mahasiddhas just now, their songs, their behaviour, how they looked and so on, may seem a very far cry indeed from the Buddha and his disciples. In fact, some people even think that the Mahasiddhas and their tantric texts are a kind of perversion of Buddhism. That Buddhism has been sort of taken over by Shaivism, by the followers of Shiva and hardline, you know, Hindus. But actually, in a sense, the Mahasiddhas simply continue aspects of the Buddha's teaching and aspects of the Buddha's example. They intensify, really, certain themes that really go back to the origins of Buddhism. In fact, I think you can also say that the Marsilas represent a kind of a return to the Buddha and original Buddhism. In some senses, in some ways it's a kind of development, in some ways it's a return to some of the original ideals. And for the rest of this talk, I want to speak about the original Mahasiddha, who is, of course, the Buddha. The Buddha is the original Mahasiddha. It all, in the end, comes from the Buddha, and it all goes back to the Buddha, in the sense that he is the embodiment of enlightenment. He's not called, to the best of my knowledge, he's never called in the text a Mahasiddha, the Buddha, but a great poet, a great Buddhist poet named Matricheta, who lived in the 2nd century of the Common Era, describes the Buddha like this: "Homage to you, who have eliminated the disease of every defilement, who has removed every arrow of ignorance, who is a perfected sorcerer, who is the greatest of physicians." So notice that perfected sorcerer. It's a translation of the term Siddha Vidyadhara. Vidyadhara is another term that's often applied to the Mahasiddhas. Literally it means a holder of magical lore, a holder of magical knowledge. So the Buddha, Matricheta, is addressing the Buddha here as the great master of siddhis, of magical knowledge and magical power. Because of his attainment of supreme and perfect enlightenment, he has great magical powers. He's able to work miraculous transformations, especially the greatest of all magics, the power of turning man into Buddha, the power of giving any man or any woman the means whereby they can transform themselves into a Buddha. So this is why we have this painting here at the centre, because the Buddha, in the end, is our great spiritual ideal. And the artist who painted it, I think I said this last night, when I told him about the retreat we were doing, and the fact that I saw the Mahasiddhas as a kind of expression of the Buddha, he painted all that with all that in mind, as it were, when he did this painting. So yes, the Buddha gave people the greatest magical practice of all, how to transform themselves into a Buddha, which is of course what the Buddha did with himself. I'm sure you all know that he started life as an ordinary man, a prince certainly, but a man. And you all know the story of his struggle and effort to discover the way to liberation, to find freedom from the round of birth and death, and freedom from the bonds of ignorance. At Gaya, at Aruvila, now known as Buddha Gaya, he found and won that freedom. And you find him seated under the great trees, the depiction of him, of his enlightenment, and the weeks that followed, the pictures of him in the text. He's seated in the forest meditating. It seems that he spent weeks, months after his great awakening, just in the forest, just under the trees, in his patched robes, just sitting on the grass, just, well, meditating, if you can really call it that. He didn't feel like going anywhere. He just sat under the great trees, just letting the awakening unfold. Or didn't really need to let it unfold. It just unfolded. And one of the text from the oldest strata of Buddhist canonical literature, the Pali texts, describe it very simply, very beautifully, like this. "Thus have I heard. At one time the Bhagawan was staying at Aruvila, beside the river Naranjara, at the foot of the Bodhi tree, having just attained full awakening. At that time, the Bhagawan sat cross-legged for 7 days in one session, experiencing the bliss of liberation. At that time, the Bhagawan sat cross-legged for 7 days in one session, experiencing the bliss of liberation." He sits for 7 days in one session, So 7, of course, is a kind of magic number in India. It really means, I'm sure he did sit that long, maybe longer, but the fact that the number 7 is mentioned really means that he dwells out of time, in a timeless zone, non-zone. He's in a space, if you can call it a space, where all notions, all ideas, all concepts of space and time have come to an end. He's stopped. You get this term in early Buddhism, Nirodha, which means stopping, which people find a bit negative, but it's not negative. It's an incredibly positive term, actually. It's the stopping, the ending of all conceptualization, of all ideas, all ideation about how things should be and ought to be, and all the clinging that derives from that conceptualization. It just all stops, vanishes into space. And what then opens up is liberation, vimoksha. And the term that you find in this text, which is translated as the bliss of liberation, is vimoksha sukha, the bliss, the happiness of liberation, of freedom. The Buddha sits in bliss. No ordinary bliss, no ordinary happiness. Our idea of bliss and happiness takes place within the framework of self and other, subject and object. His takes place, well, doesn't take place anywhere, because it's the transcendence of self and other, the stopping of the distinction between self and other. So it's wide open bliss. The bliss, the happiness with no closure, no ending, rich and deep. Didn't mean he went round with an inane grin on his face all the time. It was a deep, deep, deep bliss. So a number of suttas which describes the Buddha, that describe the Buddha's enlightenment, describe it in this way, describe him seated in the vimoksha sukha, the bliss of liberation. And then the Buddha turned his mind to his realization. Out of that experience of liberation, of bliss, he turned his mind to his realization. He kind of reflected upon it. From that experience of the bliss of liberation, for example, he turned his mind to contemplate Pratityasamutpada, reality as conditioned co-production, saw that there was no soul, no self, no essence anywhere. All there is the rise and fall of phenomena, interacting and mutually conditioning one another. But whatever reflection or experience that goes on after his enlightenment, it is depicted as arising out of this experience of the bliss of liberation. I think this particular detail in the Pali text hasn't been given sufficient attention. I think it needs more. But it's there, it's central, it's a little detail. But it's absolutely central. Bodhi is bliss, the bliss of liberation. The Buddha is a blissful being. So bliss, sukha, happiness, is right at the heart, right at the origins of the Dharma, of the Buddha's enlightenment. And bliss, of course, is a big subject for the Mahasiddhas. As I've already said, for them, enlightenment was Mahasukha, great bliss. They would describe it also as yuganadha, the union, the not-two-ness of bliss and emptiness. It was sahaja sukha, natural bliss, spontaneous bliss. Reality itself is bliss. It's not different from bliss. As a tantra says, the world is pervaded by bliss, which is both the pervader and the pervaded. Bliss is everywhere, and the Mahasiddhas sang from it. But it's not a new idea. They're following the Buddha's experience. This is one of the things I hope to take up at some point in greater detail. The whole theme of bliss, happiness, suffering, dissatisfaction. I don't know whether we'll get to it, but I think it's a very interesting topic. Because we all want to be happy. Unless we're weird. And the Buddha didn't just, as it were, reflect upon his experience or see into things in that, as it were, which produced a sort of set of ideas, a set of concepts to communicate with. Other things seem to go on as well, which are described using image and symbol. Perhaps they depict a kind of visionary experience. One of these concerns the king of the Nagas, Muchalinda. The Nagas are the serpent deities, very important in Indian tradition. They live in the rivers and streams and lakes and seas, and they make the rain fall. Very, very powerful deities indeed. So once again, we find the Buddha absorbed in the bliss of liberation for 7 days in one session. And then there's a great storm out of season. It's not the right time for storms. It's not the rainy season, but a great storm just overwhelms Gaya. And there's rain and wind and thunder and 7 days of rain. And so the Naga king, the serpent king, Muchalinda, the king of all the Nagas himself, appears. And he wraps himself 7 times around the Buddha, covering the Buddha's head with his great hood to protect him, the text says, from cold and heat and flies and mosquitoes, from wind and sun and rain and creepy crawlies. And then the rain stops, the clouds clear, and the Buddha emerges from his absorption. Muchalinda unravels himself from around the Buddha, and then the great snake transforms himself into a beautiful youth, a prince, who then bows to the Buddha and disappears. It's a very, very beautiful, very mysterious episode that you find in the texts. Of course, it can be taken on many levels, but one explanation tells us that this is a description of the Buddha's enlightenment in terms of the complete and utter transformation of the psychophysical organism. The complete and utter transformation of the subtle body, made up of chakras and spiritual centres and subtle pathways and energies. The rainstorm is the great bliss that descends from the highest chakra of all, the crown of the head. And Muchalinda is the rising energy from the root chakra, the snake winding himself around the Buddha's body 7 times, is the rising energy from the root chakra. All the energy is transformed, and the youth symbolizes the Buddha's spiritual body, ever youthful, ever fresh. This is an incredibly important event because I think it symbolizes, it illustrates that enlightenment doesn't exist in some abstract space. Bodhi is embodied. It expresses itself in form, in the body, in the psychophysical organism, in the subtle body, in the spiritual body. Again, this is a very big concern of the Mahasiddhas. They're not really interested in abstract philosophy. They're not interested in nirvana as being separate from the world, separate from actual physical experience, emotional experience. Reality is to experience in the body, in form. Mind is not different from body in that sense. And many of their songs describe the yoga of transforming the body, transforming the whole psychophysical organism and attaining the Vajrakaya. Vajra means adamantine, indestructible, the indestructible body, which isn't really a body of flesh and blood. That may come and go, but the Vajrakaya, the indestructible body, doesn't come and go. It's ever fresh and ever youthful. The body for the Mahasiddhas is a kind of temple of the archetypes of reality. It's filled with Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and gods and goddesses. It is itself a mandala, a sacred circle of significant symbols. And it's an abode of joy, an abode of bliss. This is the song of Nalinapa's realization, one of the Mahasiddhas. In the lotus at the crown of my head lie germinating seeds of joy. In my throat center is supreme joy. In my heart center, detached joy. And in my gut center, innate sahaja joy. and the unsurpassable attainment. So every centre is a different kind of joy, a different kind of enlightened joy, as it were. This is why the human body is regarded in the Siddha tradition as being incredibly precious. Our human existence is so precious, it's so important, it's such a gift. We really do have to make the very best of it. It's such a gift. It's regarded as a kind of temple of realization. The great Mahasiddha Saraha sings, "I have visited in my wanderings shrines and other places of pilgrimage, but I have not seen another shrine as blissful as my own body." Of course, this is quite different. We should just add this. Quite different from the sort of body beautiful culture that you find in the Sunday supplements and all that kind of thing. We're talking about something very, very different. So don't get confused there, which is so kind of egotistical and self-centered very often. For the Mahasiddhas, it's the same for everybody. They saw the bliss everywhere, the Buddha potential everywhere. Everybody's body is a temple for a place of practice, a place where you gain enlightenment. They saw the Buddha potential, the Buddha nature everywhere, in all beings, in all people. They know no discrimination, therefore, between people of different castes and classes and so on. And of course, in that respect, they followed the Buddha himself. Again, we can refer back to the Buddha in the forest. Again, we find a description where he's absorbed for 7 days in the bliss of liberation. And after that 7-day session, somebody comes along to have a look at him. And this somebody is a Brahmin, a member of the priestly caste, the so-called highest caste, probably from the local village. He's heard that there's some yogi, some ascetic, some wanderer meditating in the forest, and he wants to check him out. He wants to see who this guy is, and if he's, what the rumours are saying he's cracked up to be. And the text says that this Brahmin is haughty and conceited, because of course the Brahmin did regard themselves as being gods on earth, divine men by virtue of their birth. And this particular Brahmin was very haughty, very conceited. So he comes to the Buddha and he says, "What's a true Brahmin? Tell me what a Brahmin is." He wants to find out where the Buddha stands really in relation to caste. What makes someone of the highest caste? So he's really saying, well, are you a Brahmin? That's what he's asking. He's trying to work out the social relationship. And the Buddha is just very direct. Doesn't say anything about birth. Doesn't say anything about reciting the Vedas. Doesn't say anything about wearing a sacred thread, about washing in the Ganges and all the rest of it. Doesn't talk about breeding or social standing. He says the true Brahmin, or if you like, the truly divine man, is a man who's given up evil states, who's not conceited, who's pure, who's self-controlled, who has perfect understanding, who's followed the path, and who's destroyed the ashravas, or the inner poison drives, if you like, the defilements. In other words, the truly divine man is the enlightened man. So a very interesting detail this, that so soon after his enlightenment, the Buddha meets a Brahmin, and a question comes up about caste. And the Buddha's response is to get straight to the point. It's not your birth, or your class, or your caste that makes you something. It's your spiritual worth. It's your ethical and spiritual qualities that make you something. So it's very interesting. Very soon after the Buddha's enlightenment, there's an immediate social relevance. There's an immediate social critique. The social dimension comes in, coming out as an expression of the Buddha's wisdom and compassion. It's a great theme throughout the Buddha's life. His criticism of the caste system, his criticism of Brahmanism, his insistence that there are no distinctions between caste and class, that it's the human being who is first and foremost. And of course, it got him into trouble on many occasions. He was often hated for undermining the control and the power of the Brahmins in particular. The Buddha's own Sangha was made up of people from all castes and all communities. And the Mahasiddhas continue this tradition very strongly indeed. In fact, they push it much, much further. There's a strong element in the lives of the Mahasiddhas of breaking the taboos of caste. It does seem that by the time the Siddhas appeared on the scene, the 6th century, that Brahmanism and caste taboo and all that sort of thing had got stronger. Even though Buddhism had fought against that, it was very hard to keep it away. And it didn't, if anything, it had become stronger by the time of the arising of the Siddhas. So many of the Mahasiddhas are very concerned to smash through taboo. Many of them have low caste or even outcaste origin, so-called. And yes, there might well have been a certain kind of Brahmanization of Buddhism as Buddhism had become more institutionalized. Well, the Mahasiddhas wanted to break that up and get back to the vision of the Buddha. So they often did some very, very weird things indeed to go against Brahmanization. We'll be hearing about that a bit tomorrow and the next day, I think. But yes, the Siddhas really wanted to get back to the vision of the Buddha. Because the last vision, if you like, in the sequence in the forest after his enlightenment, again coming out of sitting in the bliss of liberation, is that wonderful vision which I've certainly mentioned many times. You've heard me talk about it many times, those of you who've been here before. Probably I've mentioned it on just about every retreat more than once. But this vision where the Buddha looks on the world with his Buddha eye, his eye of enlightenment itself. And, well, if it's his Buddha eye looking, in a way, you can't say what he sees. It's beyond any description. But he uses a metaphor, he uses a simile to try and get near to that vision. So he says it was like looking at a great lake of lotus flowers. All beings, all people, all men, all women, are like lotus flowers in a great lake. Red and white and blue lotuses growing in a great lake. Some are like lotuses stuck in the mud, their buds closed to the sun. But others are like lotuses pushing up out of the mud and opening to the sunshine. So when he saw this, saw, in other words, the potential for all beings, that everybody had the Buddha nature. Everybody had the potential for the attainment of enlightenment that he had. It was as if his actual Buddhahood was looking at our potential Buddhahood. When he saw this, there arose in him something that's called anukampa, which means literally to shake with. That's what it literally means, to shake with. It's usually translated as compassion. I think the etymology of compassion is to feel with. Compassio, I think that's what it is. But anukampa is literally to shake with. His actual Buddhahood, seeing the potential Buddhahood in us, in all beings, he responds, he shakes with it, and he responds with love and compassion and even delight. Compassion for the Buddha isn't just looking on suffering and wanting to alleviate that suffering. It's actually more positive than that. It's seeing reflected in all beings Buddha nature. And the effect of that on the Buddha was action. After that great vision, he left the forest and he started to wander the world. He went on the roads, down the forest paths, went into the cities. The Buddha spent a lot of time around the great cities of northern India. Went to the towns, went to the villages. Yes, he spent time in retreat, especially during the rainy season. But he never stopped wandering. And he never stopped communicating. And he communicated with whoever he met, whoever he came across. He would talk to them. Didn't matter who they were, didn't matter what their background was. He'd tune in to where they were. He'd talk to them and he'd give them a dharma that they could use there and then. There's a remarkable passage in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which is the account of the Buddha's last days. And in that passage, the Buddha is telling his faithful disciple Ananda a bit about himself. And he said, you know, Ananda, before I'd go into assembly, a particular gathering of people, whether it was a group of Kshatriyas, of warriors, a group of Brahmins, a group of householders, a group of wanderers, or even if it was to go into a gathering of gods, the Buddha seemed to be able to go into god assemblies at will. He said, before I went into that gathering, I would always adopt the appearance and the speech of that group of people, whatever it might be. That's the way it's put in the text. I would adopt their appearance and their speech, whatever it might be. So if it was a group of householders, he would become like a householder. If it was a group of wanderers like himself, he would become like those wanderers. In other words, he tuned right into them. He, in a sense, became one of them. The Buddha seemed to have had exemplary powers, great powers of empathy. He could talk anybody's language and see the world as they saw it. Yes, he could become one of them. And throughout the Pali text, the old Buddhist texts, you see this. You see the Buddha tuning in to whoever he is with and giving them a teaching that they can use in their circumstances, a teaching that they can use precisely in their situation. And this is a great feature of the Mahasiddhas as well. It doesn't matter what you are or who you are, whether you're a doddery, senile old man, rejected by his family, we'll be hearing about him, whether you're a compulsive liar and wide boy, also shunned by society, whether you're an obese adolescent who can't actually get up from the ground, he's so fat, and feeling so dejected because of that, whether you're a king addicted to wealth, whether you're a complacent monk, a handsome youth addicted to sex, a hunter, a man who's just lost his wife, who he was totally in love with, or whether you're just an ordinary bloke, doesn't matter. The Mahasiddhas will come and talk to you. They will tune into you, and they will give you, if you listen well, the magic stone that turns base metal into gold. And they'll give you, in other words, the greatest magical rite of all, how to turn yourself into a Buddha here and now. So let's try and learn from these siddhas over the coming days. Thank you.